Good afternoon. You're listening to Unusual Sources. And I know last week we promised we were going to cover Zimbabwe. So we have on the line with us today Gregory Ilitch. And Gregory is the author of Strange Liberators, Militarism, Mayhem, and the Pursuit of Profit. It's all about the Western role in countries such as Yugoslavia and Zimbabwe. And it's been highly rated by authors like Mickey Zed from Counterpunch and Michael Parenti and Stephen Gowans and so forth. It's an excellent book. I recommend picking it up. No activist should be without it. You can get it from Amazon. Again, it's called Strange Liberators. And I'll mention that again if we get the chance. We've got Gregory with us right now, so I just wanted to start by asking, we've heard a lot in the news and in the newspapers about this, the opposition leader in Zimbabwe being beaten by police, and then we hear about how evil Mugabe is and how there's very high inflation in the country. But we really don't talk about how we got to this point, except that they kind of blame a land reform for starting this. So could you maybe sum up how we got to the point where we are today?
Okay. Well, during the long apartheid era in Rhodesia, land was confiscated from the African citizens and given to colonial settlers. And then the African citizens were herded onto their most barren land possible. And there where they had to try and eke out some kind of meager living while the few colonial settlers had taken all the wealthy land. After the triumph of the liberation movement in 1979, when the people of Zimbabwe finally won their independence and overthrew the apartheid government of Rhodesia, Great Britain and the U.S. intervened, and they had set up negotiations to determine under what conditions they would allow the Zimbabwean people to win the independence that they really had already won through force of arms. And certain conditions were imposed, among which was that land could only be reallocated to African people on a willing buyer and willing seller basis. And what that meant in reality was that the wealthy white commercial farmers would the only land that they were willing to sell off was the their least desirable land. So.
Oh, okay, wait, if I could just take a step back here. In terms of this liberation movement that happened in the 70s, you say, obviously, land was a driving factor in this, right, because of the inequality of the land. So
yes.
This is a huge issue, and now, according to this agreement, Zimbabwe has to buy back the land that was taken from it.
Exactly right. The irony of that is rarely pointed out. So basically, the Great Britain was intent on keeping the land distribution the same as it was from the apartheid era. So in other words, independence Zimbabwe would mean nothing, really, because they'd still be economically oppressed and in poverty. So Zimbabwe, which wouldn't have the money at hand in the first place, would have to buy the land, and only the land that the commercial farmers were willing to sell. Of course, they didn't have the means to do so, really, and so Great Britain promised to provide $90 million, which is really a paltry sum, to help fund that. In the end, they paid barely half of that amount before they just pulled the plug on that program altogether and expected Zimbabwe to fund it entirely. So consequently, by 1997, very little land had changed hands, and the land distribution was still basically that of the apartheid era. The average white commercial farm was 2,500 hectares, and the average black farm was just a mere 2.
In terms of productivity, some people have criticized the land reform. I mean, how did the land reform work out? When they redistributed the land and gave it to Zimbabweans, did it work out, or were they able to become productive?
Well, that land that was redistributed early on, there have been a number of agricultural studies, and they found that, like anywhere, land reform has the temporary economic dislocation where there'll be a drop in production for maybe 5-7 years or whatever. And then after that, it really takes off, and in the end, the land is actually far more productive than it was in the first place. But key components of that is that assistance be given to resettled farmers, including financial loans and fertilizer and so forth. But in this latest round of land reform, the fast-track land reform, Western sanctions have pretty much made the essential assistance to farmers impossible, as the foreign currency is just about dried up due to the sanctions.
Sanctions. Okay, wait a minute. When did the sanctions happen?
Officially, in 2001, President Bush signed a bill that was co-sponsored by former Senator Jesse Helms, the one-time supporter of apartheid Rhodesia. And it was the Zimbabwe Democracy and Economic Recovery Act. And this instructed U.S. officials in international financial institutions to vote against and to block any international assistance to Zimbabwe whatsoever. And Great Britain's been doing the same, as well as the European Union. So basically, Zimbabwe has not been able to get any financial transactions to international lending institutions and so forth.
What was the rationale for doing this?
The official rationale was to change the government in a what they would term a more desirable direction. In other words, one that would be, they wouldn't say this out loud, but one that would be friendly to Western corporate investment.
So the U.S. was looking for a more amenable client regime. How do you go about doing that?
Well, you find a an opposition party that's willing to implement the programs. And so the new opposition party was created. And the Movement for Democratic Change, and their program explicitly called for total privatization of all state-owned firms, tax incentives for Western corporations, and special advantages for Western corporations that wanted to bid on these privatized firms. So millions of dollars were pumped into the bank accounts of the Movement for Democratic Change.
And what are the white farmers doing this whole time?
Basically, the white commercial farmers were just carrying on as before. They were not going to be willing to sell off any more land. They had already disposed of the land they didn't want, which was very little. And they expected to continue holding on to their huge farms.
Well, what's happening on these farms? I mean, we hear about the productivity of the white estates. They were funded for a long time by the Rhodesian government beforehand. But are all these estates being used to produce food then?
No, primarily the white commercial farmers concentrated on growing tobacco and cotton and non-food crops. And actually, even before fast-track land reform, black farmers were responsible for growing 70% of the maize, which is the staple crop in Zimbabwe.
Obviously, it would be nice to make use of export crops like tobacco, but you say there's sanctions on the country which make this sort of difficult. And I guess one of the things that Bush and Blair have been saying about sanctioning Zimbabwe is that it's necessary to change the regime, which they say is not democratic. So my question to you then would be, do you think that Zimbabwe is a democracy, that Mugabe's party, ZANU, is democratic, and how does the MDC compare?
Well, democracy is kind of a vague term. It's in the eye of the beholder. So there's no absolute perfection, no matter where you look in the world, but Zimbabwe is a good deal more democratic than it's given credit for. The privately owned press is entirely with the exception of the Daily Mirror, is entirely for the opposition. And if you ever read some of the opposition press, they're pretty vehement in their articles. So there's certainly freedom of speech in the press there. The elections have consistently gotten good reviews from observers from other African nations. The elections have been criticized by Western countries, but they've had no observers on the ground.
Well, let's talk about that for a moment, actually, because one of the things that you'll see if you read the Washington Post or the BBC is that the South Africa's president, for example, is criticized for not being hard enough on Mugabe. And a lot of the countries that are surrounding Zimbabwe seem sympathetic. And when Mugabe travels to these countries, he gets a lot of applause, and all the leaders of those countries want to shake his hand. So why is there different feelings, or such different feelings, for Zimbabwe in terms of its neighbors compared to with the West?
Well, in the African nations, Zimbabwe has a special place because it's directly challenging the Western role and freely distributing its land to the people. So it's very few countries are willing to challenge the West quite so directly. So in a way, there's a lot riding on how things turn out in Zimbabwe. it's very popular, this land reform program, throughout Africa, and it's gotten a lot of attention and largely support. But the West tends to treat people like South African President Thabo Mbeki as if he's supposed to be some kind of servant, you know, like they give him an order, like, go pressure Zimbabwe for us. And it's really quite insulting. So there's that element, too, that African leaders are not really too thrilled to be pushed around like that.
Well, that's not something we typically hear about. But what we do hear about, of course, is this recent beating of the opposition leader. How do you pronounce his name again?
Morgan Tsvangirai.
Tsvangirai, okay.
It doesn't look like it's how it's spelled.
What do we know about the opposition leader? I mean, they're not talking very much about the MDC's policy or his history. So do you know what was happening in terms of the recent police confrontation?
Yeah, there's just to give maybe background just on the very recent part. Morgan Tsvangirai, he's leader of the part of the MDC that's split, that advocates no longer taking part in elections. And Tsvangirai has come out explicitly and said that he wants to mass confrontation, that's his exact phrase, to overthrow the government. Basically, he's looking to do what happened in Yugoslavia or Georgia, Ukraine, and have mass demonstrations topple the government through non-democratic means. Earlier on, he had met with Dickens and Matson, a public relations firm, that he was given to understand had ties to the CIA, and he was feeling them out for a plot to possibly assassinate President Mugabe, and certainly at the very minimum to a coup that would overthrow him. And in the past, he's also called for the violent overthrow of the government, so he's got this history. In January, he was calling for mass demonstrations again, and some demonstrations turned violent. So the Zimbabwean government imposed a 3-month ban on demonstrations. And this month, Tsvangirai called for what he termed for Western reporters a prayer meeting. But actually on the leaflets that were posted, it was called a defiance campaign and a demonstration. And thousands of supporters of the MDC came out for a demonstration.
Wait a minute, sorry, they didn't report that. I didn't see
no.
that in the Hamilton Spectator. It just said, you know, it says prayer meeting. It didn't say anything about defiance campaign or illegal demonstration.
Yeah, it sounds very innocuous. It's part of the propaganda campaign. So basically, Zimbabwe is reaching a crisis point for a variety of reasons. It's already an economic crisis because of Western-imposed sanctions. And then you have this opposition leader who's calling for the violent overthrow of the government. So anyways, the opposition members, they were building barricades in the streets and stoning cars and burning buses and petrol bombs at two police stations they set off. So about a couple of dozen police came to this demonstration where they had thousands of MDC demonstrators, and they tried to shut the demonstration down. Well, it ended up being basically a pitched battle between the police and the demonstrators. And several of the police had their batons taken from them, and opposition members beat them until they were unconscious. One opposition member was shot dead. In the end, those police were able to get away, managed to take several of the demonstrators to police stations. And Morgan Tsvangirai was one who was taken to a police station. At one station, opposition members were told to lay down on the floor, and then they were beaten quite severely for a period up to an hour. Other police stations, the arrested members of the opposition were treated with respect. Apparently, at this one station, there was a pro-government militia, and the police were basically pushed aside while this militia beat the opposition members. It's kind of interesting to observe how the Western reports covered the beating of Morgan Tsvangirai. His beating was certainly severe enough, and there's no excuse for that. But it was deliberately exaggerated, too. So, for instance, the Associated Press had a headline saying, Tsvangirai has fractured skull. And then you read the text of the report, and it's actually Tsvangirai's lawyer saying that he might have a fractured skull. But the headlines were quite definite about that. But he was taken to the hospital, and he was given a scan. And interestingly enough, I was waiting to see the results of that scan. It was never reported in the Western press except one French report, where it turned out that there was no fractured skull, no scalp injury, and no brain damage. But the Western reports continued reporting that he had a fractured skull. So, as I said, the beating was certainly bad enough, but it's also being exaggerated.
There's no excuse for violence, but you have to wonder, what would happen if something like this happened in the United States? What if some opposition in the States was being funded by a foreign government, and then this opposition called for coup d'etat, and they went out in the streets and had campaigns of violence? Wouldn't they be repressed by riot police, too?
Yeah, more than repressed. Yeah, I think you'd be seeing very similar or even worse going on. And the only reason this is being singled out is because the West wants to overthrow the government themselves of Zimbabwe. So, obviously, no government is going to just sit idly by and wait to be overthrown. So the Zimbabwean police are very vigilant here, and unfortunately this one group, this one militia, was let their emotions get the best of them. But its stakes are high, and the emotions are running high right now.
You mentioned before a parallel to the Orange Revolution in the Ukraine.
Right.
So we know that's when, again, we heard a lot about how great this democratic revolution that was happening in the Ukraine, all these NGOs and students were given money to go out in the streets and have a tent city with laser light shows and stuff. And I think now the Ukrainian people have actually voted out most of that Orange Revolution.
Yes, right.
But that's what they're calling for. So the bishops in Zimbabwe have called for Orange Revolutions as well, and the Sokwenel opposition group, if I understand right. So what does this mean? I mean, looking at the big picture, if people in Zimbabwe are calling for things that happen in Ukraine and Yugoslavia, you know, what's the connection here? Where do the NGOs fit in and Western opinion?
NGOs are actually sort of a relatively new tool that Western governments are using to influence and even alter the course of events in other countries. A lot of the activities that they do used to be done by the CIA, you know, funding trade unions and opposition groups and paying for their media and so forth and so on. Now NGOs are doing it, and they have like an image of being supportive of civil rights and civil society, but the image doesn't really match what's going on behind the scenes. They're really in the pocket of Western nations and seeking to impose change in a direction that the U.S. and Great Britain desire. In other words, more Western corporate investment and so on.
Well, let's talk about that, because Tony Blair has said that he works with the MDC to determine policy and how the opposition should work in Zimbabwe. So, you know, what is it that they're trying to change? We don't hear much about the government. Like, once Mugabe's party, the ZANU, got in power in the 1980s, what did they start doing?
Initially, they announced that they were going for a socialist government, but the constitution that the U.S. and Great Britain had imposed really limited what could be done, as there was like a 10-year period where there were certain restrictions on them. After that, just about the time that 10-year agreement ran out was when the Soviet Union collapsed and Eastern European nations. So basically, it was not a fortuitous time to be building a socialist society. So under that situation, Zimbabwe felt it had no choice but to follow the standard structural adjustment program, which really led to an economic decline. But by the late 1990s, Zimbabwe had had enough of that. It was completely fed up with being the servant of the West and putting its economy at their disposal. And they said, and President Mugabe said, enough is enough. The structural adjustment program is no more. We're going to basically put our economy at the service of our own people. And so basically the percentage of percentage of companies owned by Western corporations in Zimbabwe has gone way down. And there's firm support for state-owned companies. It's just not what the Western nations are looking for. They want total privatization.
So they told the IMF to go away, basically.
Yeah, basically, right. Yeah, the IMF had conditions that it was, as usual, demanding, you know, for instance, instituting fees for students at schools. So, in other words, poor families wouldn't be able to go to school. Instituting fees for health service, so poor people wouldn't be able to get the health care that they need. privatizing companies, and on and on. And basically Zimbabwe said, no, these conditions are not acceptable to us. We're going to do what we feel is best for our people.
And we see how that turns out with the pressure that's put on them. And if you know, it seems to me this reminds me a lot of what's happening in places like South America with Venezuela and Argentina. They told the IMF to go away. Venezuela starts bankrolling, you know, its own investment development schemes, and the U.S. starts pressuring Venezuela and saying it's undemocratic. And now you've got an opposition in Venezuela, which half the time doesn't run in elections and instead just does coup attempts or protests or talks to the West. So do you think there's a parallel between the way opposition works in countries like Venezuela, Zimbabwe, maybe even Haiti?
There's more than a parallel. I mean, it's a very direct connection, and for the same reasons. There's nothing that the U.S. and Great Britain won't do to undermine a country that's not obeying orders. And so it's exactly the same thing going on. Venezuela's lucky because they have a good deal of oil, and they also have some other Latin American countries that are following a somewhat similar path so they can rely on each other for support. Zimbabwe is more or less isolated in that respect.
They're beating Zimbabwe like a redheaded stepchild. You know, and it seems to me that the prospects are bleak for the country, unfortunately. It's like the punching bag for the land reform, right? Because South Africa, the whites in South Africa and people in Britain are worried, I think, that if people like Mugabe's example of land reform, they're going to try the same thing in South Africa. We focused a lot of attention on a little bit of violence in Zimbabwe, but there's also violence in South Africa, too.
Yeah, exactly right. There's actually a good deal of violence in the countryside in South Africa. Basically, the land ownership pattern is almost exactly the same as it was in the apartheid era. So people are still in desperate poverty and denied the chance to make a decent living. Well, you have these hugely, obscenely wealthy farms still held in the hands of a wealthy few. So Zimbabwe is definitely the threat of a good example that the U.S. and Great Britain want to crush. And actually, Namibia, too, is another nation where there's still the same land ownership pattern. So if land reform were allowed to succeed in Zimbabwe, that's an example that could not be stopped. I think you'd see change sweeping through Africa.
Well, let's look at the way forward then. I mean, I know it does look bleak, as I said, but what do you think Zimbabwe should do or could do or the whole South African land struggle can do? Because I'm not sure about what the electoral climate is like there. How much support does ZANU have, where it comes from in the opposition? What possibilities for change are there, or is it just going to get worse?
I'm kind of reluctant to speculate about the future, but one thing I can say is actually ZANU PF has a large majority of support in Zimbabwe. The problem is that support is overwhelmingly in the rural areas, whereas the opposition support is overwhelmingly in the urban areas. And the urban areas are exactly the right pressure points where they can bring down the government. So even though the opposition has a minority of support, their support is situated in the place where it could have the most effect.
What exactly is the MDC's political program? If they got in power, if we finally forced Zimbabwe to, you know, to make Mugabe step down or something, what would happen if the opposition took power, in your view?
Well, they'd immediately start a program of privatizing all state-owned firms and downsizing, and you'd see actually kind of the same thing happen in Yugoslavia. Huge rise in unemployment and poverty, and the Western corporations coming in and buying up these state-owned firms at a mere fraction of their actual value. And I think you would probably also see a reversal to some extent in the land reform. I don't think they could do it completely because they'd have quite a backlash on their hands from the people who are being dispossessed, but I think they would make some effort to reverse at least some of the land reform.
Well, Gregory, I know you've also done work on Yugoslavia, as you say. It's within your book. And I was just reading the news, and it keeps popping up that Kosovo might have this referendum for secession. I was told that, you know, the Serbs were kind of paranoid for thinking that the West was going to take Kosovo away from Serbia. But did you think this could happen?
Oh, it's definitely going to happen. Nothing's going to happen that the U.S. doesn't want to happen. And they're already determined to basically tear Kosovo out of Yugoslavia, or I guess now it's called Serbia, and uh, give Soviet independence.
So I guess, as you said, there is relations between all of these things in the world. I guess it seems to me you should really be on alert when our media starts telling you about how bad a government is. Don't they call Mugabe the African Hitler sometimes?
Yeah, I think I've encountered that. I've also encountered the term the African Pol Pot, which is really over the top.
Right, it's year zero in Zimbabwe. Okay,
yeah.
Well, so we've got the African Hitler, Mugabe, then there's, remember, Milosevic was the next Hitler a few years back. But in any case, thanks very much for covering Zimbabwe with us today and all these other issues. The breadth of knowledge that you bring to this is just amazing because you've studied all these different countries. And again, I would have to recommend that people pick up your book, Strange Liberators. It's titled Strange Liberators, subtitled Militarism, Mayhem, and the Pursuit of Profit, and that's by Gregory Elich, E-L-I-C-H. Also, there's other publications, The New African, I think, with Balfour Ankoma. There's another site called Zimbabwe Watch that I think some of your articles are actually featured on. So I'll try to get a web address for that, too. So, in any case, thanks very much for sharing this with us today.
Thank you.
And hopefully can catch up on this later if there's more developments. I'd like to thank you for being on the show. And until next week, take care.